Awesome. Welcome back to another fantastic episode of UAP Studies. My name is Jason, of course. Michael Glosson, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. I'm highly caffeinated for this interview for some reason, but
I'm getting there.
Riding downward on that caffeine wave, so I think we'll be okay. Our guest today is Gordon White. He's a person that I have wanted to have on the podcast ever since you asked me to join on, because one of my main interests in working with the UAP community is to expand the view of ideas and concepts and theories and ways of thinking that can be enlightening for investigating a phenomenon that we just don't yet have the right conceptual toolbox for, or the right set of methods for understanding yet. That's what at least UAP feels like to me. And so Gordon has a podcast that I found through looking for interviews with Diana Pasulka, who wrote American Cosmic, and he had an interview with her on there. And just as her book was my sort of entree into the thinking that there's like a there for the UAP phenomenon, his podcast was my entree into thinking that there's a there for the world of the occult, which is something that I had up until that point only associated with, I don't know, like goth high schoolers who claim to be Wiccan and maybe Penn and Teller telling histories of like where magic tricks came from or something. But I'm at this point at least intrigued and convinced that there's more there, and it's mostly thanks to my initial encounter with Gordon. His podcast is called Rune Soup. I think he has other media outlets that he works with, but that's the one that I'm most familiar with. He's recently the author of two books, one called Animistic Encounters with a Living Cosmos, and another, Starships, a Prehistory of the Spirits, or Prehistory of the Spirit World, is that it?
Prehistory of the Spirits.
It's Prehistory of the Spirits, both of which in some way touch on either the UAP phenomenon or things that are not too far apart from the phenomenon. So Gordon was kind enough to join us at 8 a.m. from Tasmania, where he lives. And so thanks for being here.
Yeah, real trooper.
I wanted to start out our interview with a question that I've heard you ask often, but that I've always wanted to hear your answer to. Gordon, were you a weird kid?
I was, in retrospect. I think most people are. It's one of the reasons I asked the question. So I was precocious. I hit a bunch of verbal and reading milestones early. I was reading Lord of the Rings independently at 6.
Oh, wow.
It turns out, upon many subsequent rereadings, that I might have missed some of it at the age of 6.
But still, that's impressive. Yeah.
Gone over. Yeah, yeah, yeah. My dad tells a story of one of his parents compete, especially when I have young children. One of his friends was over, and his friend's daughter is the same age as me. So, that, you know, always. And his friend asked him, is Gordon reading independently yet? And I walked by with my finger in where I was at in the Lord of the Rings at just that moment. So he still tells that story, still dines out on it. But I kind of, in retrospect, have looked at some things that made me realize that was a little unusual. It was, in fact, when I started finding ufology, which was after magic. So mid-20s, I would say. And looking at this notion of screen memories and so on, I would have hag attack type sleep paralysis experiences as a kid, and a recurring nightmare that was another sleep paralysis one where I would shrink. I wouldn't be able to move, obviously, and I would shrink in size to the point that the weave of the fitted sheet would be about as thick as ship ropes, and that would immobilize me. And in the room was, I don't know if you remember He-Man, but like Buzz Off. Mm-hmm. So like I had like a bug humanoid in the room, and I had visions of enormous knitting needles, like huge needles. And when I was in the ship ropes, I'd be trapped, and I would see a Romulan warbird. So and that would happen. That was a recurring dream. And it might just be a sleep paralysis nightmare, of course, I don't know. But once I got to John Mack and so on in the screen memory, childhood dream nightmare kind of world, a little bit, I just sort of looked back on my own experiences and thought, wait a minute, that might have been something given how the rest of my life turned out. Because that's one of the reasons I asked the question. It is partially inspired by Jacques Vallée, who famously with his Hynek research, realized that people who in adulthood became experiencers would have some kind of childhood experience. And he included himself in that when he was 14 and saw some kind of thing in the sky still in France. So I asked that question as a framing. One, it just loosens people up for a conversation, but sure. It's really interesting on two levels to see if people who end up on a show like Rune Soup do have weird childhoods, but also how they narrativize it. So I get to learn two things about them. And my coming to that question was on that sort of level. When it comes to magic, I had, and I don't remember these dreams, but I woke up when I was 13, the sunny Saturday morning in regional Australia, and I was aware that something had happened in my dream state, probably about 5 a.m. then. And I just kind of sat bolt upright in bed, looked how much money I had, because I was refereeing soccer at the time, which meant I was rich compared to my friends, stole some more money from my mother, from her purse, walked the several miles down the hill to a thing that we used to have in the world, but we don't anymore, which is a good independent bookstore. And I have never found an independent bookstore as good as, it was called Book Hog in the Junction in Newcastle, Australia. And I bought a bunch of, in retrospect, maybe not very good, neo-paganism and magic books and a packet of cigarettes because I was 13 and went and sat in the local grandstand. And that was it for me. That was, and cigarettes lasted a while too. They lasted another 15 years on top of that. But magic.
That was a big pack. I'm choking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know what it was, but there was just a moment I woke up and I was 13 and I'm like, I'm going to do magic. And that was the beginning of it for me.
So magic at that time, was it like, what was your conception of magic prior to buying books and learning the sort of like pagan framework of it? I mean, did you think of it as like card tricks or something deeper?
We had, no. Another experience, I would sporadically see something like dead people or spirits, particularly when I was unwell. So my father grew up in Nauru and New Guinea in Melanesia. So that's home for him. So our childhood vacations would be, it sounds impossibly exotic to people who don't live in this corner of the world. We would go to Samoa or Fiji or what have you on a yearly basis. And it is exotic, right? But my parents had also worked out that it was cheaper to do that. Australia is a very expensive country. It's cheaper to take a family to Fiji in the 80s than it is to take them to Queensland, which is what all my friends in school would do. Driving up there and the cost of everything, you arbitrage it and end up being cheaper. So it sounds like, I mean, I'm very grateful for it, obviously, but it sounds a bit more Kardashian these days than it was. So I would get inevitably sick with tropical illnesses when we were there. And one time I saw someone, like a play out of, I presume someone had died underneath a coconut tree in that real Henry Sugar kind of sense of hit by a coconut tree and fell over. And I kept seeing this play out. And then in the room, I saw these dancing coconut spirits to the point that I would have been about 11 at this point. So I was aware I was sick. And I'm like, these aren't there. Because they're dancing coconuts on a couch next to the bed. And I got up and I walked right up to them and I could see them. That's what they were. So that sort of thing would happen. And we had a show in Australia called The Extraordinary when I was a kid. It was an 80s show. I'm not sure if it's all still on YouTube. I found it about 10 years ago. Incredible. And you probably couldn't. It was terrifying. We have Unsolved Mysteries and so on Netflix now. But this was... balls to the wall, paranormal. And it was, and the presenter, Warwick Moss, stopped presenting in about season two in the locations because he went to one location in the Northern Territory that was essentially an Aboriginal cursed location. And he saw some shit there that freaked him out. So he's like, I'm not doing location stuff anymore.
So it was like a paranormal investigation sort of show?
It wasn't. That's the thing. It was more just telling these ghost stories.
Okay.
So it's pre that, which South Park does so well in pillaring, but it was pre ghost hunting shows where you just show up somewhere and use a night vision camera to scare each other. This was just like telling weird stories about people who had really crazy high strange encounters. So by the time I hit 13, and I loved that stuff, like that sort of weird kid, by the time I hit 13, sure. I was aware that like spirits are real and whatever. So I didn't think magic was Penn and Teller tricks. I didn't really know what it was. I knew spirits were real and probably something like magic has something to do with that. That's about as far as my 13-year-old mind conceptualized it. But I didn't need to be convinced of magic's reality by magic because I had encountered it prior to that.
So it sounds like you're in. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to ask when it comes out, because I don't know anything about magic, but is it something that opens up something in the mind that allows you to get a little bit more abilities? Is it something that, you know, because we always think it must be some sort of spells or incantations of some sort. What is the root source of magic? Are we using words and language as a powerful means? Because they do have power. Words have power. So I'm just curious on how that works and what did you find about it?
All of the above. Magic, and I'm working on this in the second, well, it's the final book of my Dot trilogy, which is what I call Starships and Animistic. I'm working on this one now. And the producers of Magical Egypt asked me to film a definition. I'm on the next season of what I think magic is. And it was really fun to sit with that because that's changed a lot over time. The thing is, magic, I'll start the description here because of the nature of this show. Magic is a word we use for the natural functioning human capacities, not mind capacities. That's too much of a dualistic divide. The natural functioning capacities principally based around attending and attendance that for irregularities of European history, we have excised and decided were bad. Because if you consider the things, the practices that make up magic, astrology, so sacred timing, and praying and telepathy and all these kind of things, no one else banned them. Like the idea that sacred timing is forbidden happens because of the peculiarities of European history, namely that the Christians inherited ancient Rome's suspicion of things like magic and soothsaying and built this whole terrifying infrastructure, terrifying legal infrastructure around it. But the stuff that's contained within it is not only benign, well, that's not true. The stuff that's contained within it, it's like making breathing or defecating satanic. It's like, yeah, this is a normal functioning of a normal human that we find elsewhere in the world. And so magic's a slippery definition because it means something to us that it doesn't, that it means differently in China or South America or so on. Now, with that being said, my definition of it, which I used for Magical Egypt and for my friend Miguel's book on Elvis, of all things, it is the felt sense that our role in the universe is co-creative. And that's a inheritance and rephrasing of Hermeticism. But that's not like when you said, and I'm not wailing on you for this, but like it doesn't open up things in the mind. It is a process of attending. Like this is one of the same reason we have magic as this excise thing in the West is the same reason why we have this very unhelpful mind-body dualism. Like it's literally the same process, right? It's the same irregularity of European history that gives us an unhelpful dualism and also hives off these capacities that I think are far more embodied than they are mental.
Right.
But yes, so my definition of magic is that. And when you stay up at that level, it allows its expression through things like spells, through things like grimoires, but not just that. Like when you understand that it's that, it covers everything, the scary shit, like blood sacrifices, but it also covers remote viewing and Lynn McTaggart's intention experiments.
Right. Yeah, it encompasses a lot of different things. I think we're more acceptable to saying, look, you know, remote viewing, I'll believe in it, but I don't believe in this or I don't believe in that.
Yeah,
I think we always limit ourselves. We have our biases of what we will accept and what we won't, and nothing like Twitter to sort of point that out on, you know, what we're willing to accept and not. So yeah, to have more of a broader open-mindedness about what are the capabilities of humans, and we don't know, like we don't have, you know, supposedly we have plenty of abilities. Even ET encounters, they say that if you guys knew your potential, or if you could live up to your potential, and be something, right?
And so, I think that's exactly, and I think, and it's that Whitley Strieber observation that if he'd watched different movies as a kid, his encounters wouldn't have been as terrifying. Like we do, like the West is not, whatever the West is not ideally situated for embodied epistemology, which is what animistic is about. Like, we're just not in a good place to understand that. The reason people are okay with remote viewing, for instance, and this we can look at the Soviet experience versus the non-Soviet experience during the Cold War, because the Soviets were operating in a idiotic but nevertheless different woolly Marxist materialism. They didn't have to have a mind-body divide. They could look at telepathic capacities as biological. And that's how they managed to find things like Faraday cages before we did, because telepathy had to be some sort of biological capacity. Like, it had to exist in the cosmos. And in that, they're correct. The other stuff, not so much. But we could only get remote viewing across the line because we could call it mental phenomena. So it didn't violate our arbitrary and, as far as I'm concerned, falsified materialist premises that underpin most, let's say, funded science, right? And so we're just not in a good place. And I honestly think one of the reasons the UFO phenomena is experienced the way it is for people in the West is a corrective mechanism. Like, it needs to be a kind of weird that brings us back to, that gently moves us out of these category errors, out of these epistemological errors, and more to this embodied idea of, as far as I'm concerned, like, the cosmos is something that's fundamentally alive. So I'm really interested in why it hits different for us than Amazonian curanderos.
I think the point that you make about, for instance, the difference between how Soviet science evolved and how Western science evolved is a really good, like, starting point for understanding the locus of a lot of these, like, weird intersecting lines of thought. Like, the Soviets didn't have a sort of Christian theology that they had to protect, or even like a pseudo-Christian worldview that they had to maintain, that there was a body and a spirit and you die and you go to heaven or whatever. Like, so nothing was taboo. There was no satanic or like taboo thought, other than maybe if you were religious, that was a sort of taboo. But there were no phenomena that they said, well, we can't go that way because it just can't possibly be, right? They could reduce everything to like physics almost, which was, I think, probably also a wrong worldview, this sort of reductive physicalism or something. But it allowed them to study things that we have to just say, oh, there's not a there, even though the statistics show, I mean, like the work done at Stanford Research Institute pretty clearly, I think, shows that remote viewing experiments work for some people consistently. But we have no interpretive framework for making sense out of it, so we have to throw it out. Whereas the Russians didn't, and maybe people who come from a Aboriginal sort of historical worldview don't have that same prohibition against those thoughts. So in your book, Starships, you take a similar kind of way of thinking and say, well, let's trace back our entire like encounter of human history with the spirit world, or a world that's outside of our normal realms of experience or our normal frameworks of interpreting our experience. And you pull in all sorts of things, sort of psychedelic shamanism has some role to play in it, and a sort of reinterpretation of human techno history in Egypt and New Guinea and all over the place. And the UFO has some role to play in it too, but it's not the center of the book. I'm not sure if there is just one center. It's like all these things that you can look at through the lens of one another. But what role do UAP and UFO have to play in this like long narrative history that you present of our experience of a world outside the normal?
Cool. So I'll tell a story that that Alberto Violdo, who I learned my shamanic healing through, tells of a time he was up in the high Andes visiting the Karo. And while he was up there, there was an American tour group. It's like a UFO spotting tour. He didn't say who it was, but I think it might've been a Stephen Greer tour or something, right? So they're up there looking for little lights in the sky. And so Alberto asks the Karo Paco, the shaman that he's with, like, well, what do you think about UFOs? And he's like, well, they're real, of course. I mean, we're in a lineage of communion with the star nations. We're just not interested in the ones who come here in buses. And I just think that's the funniest thing, because the Karo live in like a 500-year-ago subsistence stone huts in the high Andes. They're not known for their public infrastructure. And they're looking down on this, not looking down on, but like, we're not interested in the one who comes here in buses, which is just the perfect description, like dismissive. I'm not that interested. This giant flying object shows up in front of you. You're like, it's a bus, which it is, you know, which it is if you're going down the little green man hypothesis. But I'm open with that because, as I'm sure you guys are aware, in ufology in general, you have a polarization between ETH and non-ETH. So it's either Marvin the Martian or it's fairies. And it's both, right? So I have every confidence, and in fact, I've been told this, but just not by little green men, that, we have visitations from off-planet occur in the context of a cosmos that is alive, which is to say there are means of coming into relation with stars, with mountains, with trees, and so on. That's what the cosmos is. It's a community of beings, which includes little green men coming here in buses. That, I think, is not... And it's funny, like, Jacques will get there sometimes. Like, Jacques Vallée will get there sometimes when you push him and he admits to being a Rosicrucian or whatever. Like, he'll get there. But it's not satisfactorily framed that way often enough for me, which is why spirits aren't UFOs. Why I play with the Star Dutch ships in the book is that it's a story of humanity, I suppose, coming into relation with the stars in every context. So it's a story of navigation. It's the story of stellar magic. It's the story of how that kind of behavior overlaps with potential visitations and so on. And it's the through line through it he died recently within the last year or so. Jake Stratton Kent was at the time probably Britain's most prominent necromancer. He was a good friend of mine. And we were talking about the origin of the list spirits, which is to say the most common list of spirits that you will find in Solomonic grimoires like the Key of Solomon and earlier and later ones. Because that's a really good... These are a collection of beings that have traveled along with practicing magicians in a European context for 800 years. And so the question is, where did they come from? And some of them have names like Baal and so on, and Astaroth. So you have Asherah and Baal. So you have some survivals of other beings into it, but you have ones that aren't as well. And the list is a really good place to begin to say, well, some of these things are this and some of them are that, and some of them just are. And that's what Starships is about. It's like the origin of the list spirits in a way, because magic does the same thing where it's like, all spirits or angels are pagan survivals. Well, they're not. Like, some are, but actually they're not. And that's where I situate like real space buses in the context of a living cosmos. Yes, it's absolutely part of the story, but it's a thing that happens in a cosmos that is a community of beings in relation.
You think space tourism is going to be high? I mean, we're doing that already with, you know, I think the Amazon owner, Jeff Bezos, and Elon Musk both do tours in space with their spacecraft. So, yeah, you would think it probably is another civilization will do too, right?
Well, yeah, they might. I mean, who knows what they're doing here? But I think, like, the Paco's point is that... The ones that come here, I'm in a technological sense, they are presumably more advanced than us, but they're not a source of wisdom for a tradition like that. The stars are a source of wisdom, so the implication is these travelers are in some kind of relation to the stars as well. It's like it's the cosmos that is the real show, and we get visitors in the same way as to what they're doing here. But I don't know. I always thought that was the right kind of framing, because it normalizes something that in its encounter is highly abnormal, right? You know, seeing one of these giant triangles or whatever, and to just be like, it's a bus, which it is, but that's, I don't know. I sit with that. There's something in that for me that I think is very centering and grounding.
So are we all just missing the point then in the sort of UAP obsessed world? Is that the message that we're eventually going to have to look beyond the crafts or whatever it is that's like emitting photons in our aerospace and look towards some other reality that sort of binds all of them together and that they're all fundamentally about.
Yes, but I wouldn't say missing the point. It's something Richard Dolan says, which I think is true. When he looks at his decades of study, he said, ufology is the most interesting subject you could possibly study because you start off, he started off as a historian of the Cold War. You start off thinking you're doing a research project in what we can and can't know from classified and potentially faked documents from during the Cold War and so on. And all of a sudden, you are studying ancient mysteries and remote viewing and meditation and all this kind of thing. So I guess I come back to that Robert Anton Wilson idea of the chapel, well, not his, but like the Chapel Perilous, where it doesn't really matter to me what, or it shouldn't really matter what your entry point into the understanding that the cosmos is some kind of sacred or some kind of alive, right? Like ufology is a perfectly valid starting point for a personal metaphysical journey of coming to an understanding of what the hell all of this is. So it's not so much that it's missing the point, it's that it's a doorway. And it's, so I came to ufology via magic. It's more common, like in this case, it's like, well, I started off with my interest in UAP. Now that appears to have some kind of thing to say about magic and vice versa, so now we're having this discussion. We all kind of center in on an attempted explanation of something much bigger than what are these little lights in the sky, like they and it's supposed, I presume what they're for is to actually open up our awareness and understanding and attending to, upon things that we have neglected attending for however long.
Sort of like Jacques Vallée's view that this is all a mechanism for disrupting like social consciousness in some sort of way towards some end. I think he has like a view that's a bit more nefarious at times, but your view is that they're here to, at least partially, or at least one of their necessary effects is that it trains our thoughts and our sort of lines of reasoning towards some higher, more integrated view of reality.
Just experience, right? And I don't even know if that's their intention. So if you think about some of the like some of the great people in history who've had changes, and here's a small version, but it's lovely. So the guy who founded actually the first Green Party in the world was in Australia, and the guy who founded it was a dentist called Gordon Brown. He's Tasmanian, and he was kayaking in a river in the southeast of Tasmania, where we have, this is like a Gondwana survival there. Like you have trees that live for like 10,000 years. You have plants that have not, that saw off the dinosaurs, like saw them coming, wow, and saw them going. Like it is ancient, right? And they were about to build a dam there. And he's like, I'm not this. He had a moment on his kayak of like, that cannot, this is, and it wasn't a moment of anger. It was a moment of profundity and sanctity. This can't happen. And he stopped it. Like that was the thing that was the cornerstone of the Green Party before it descended into the psychotic purple head mess that our Green Party is and everyone else's is now today. But back in the 80s and 70s, it was doing good things. It was actually saving like Gondwana forest, right? So his encounter, well, I would argue, is with beings, is with animism, is the understanding that the cosmos is composed of persons, only some of whom are human. So he didn't see lights in the sky. He saw 4,000-year-old trees, and that opened up. He went from some 70s Hobart dentist to a very important politician in the history of this country. So it doesn't, it's, I don't even think it needs to be their purpose, right? I honestly think it's just, oh, I now need a frame of understanding. The cosmos now needs to be big enough for me to contain what I've just encountered. So that, I think Jacques gets there as well, but it's not, they don't need to help. We don't need to be saved. Well, we definitely do need to be saved, I suppose, but like, I'm not
that
sure.
That doesn't need to be their purpose or
yeah,
their
like
own intentions
looking,
or whatever.
Looking for their motives is like, well, did those trees, they may well have had a motive in capturing Gordon Brown's attention. Not Gordon Brown, that's a former Prime Minister of Britain. Doesn't matter. But does Bob Brown, sorry. But does, I'm not sure, but I also don't think it's necessary, right? And I think we can trip ourselves up by saying, oh, well, they're here as part of a mechanism of and I actually think this is at least some of them, this works on a spirit level, is true. I think Jacques is correct that, and it's not just little lights in the sky. There are beings who derive all kinds of stuff, but let's just say food, from having humans operate and think in a specific way. And this comes back to, again, it's theory of mind stuff, right? Like what you think the imaginal is. Because, again, Western Europeans, post-Descartes, but generally just post-Enlightenment, have decided that this profound capacity is brain farts of a monkey brain trapped in a skull, and it doesn't get outside of it, which is just, I can't stress how stupid that is. On like, I'm a comparativist. It is the dumbest theory of mind humans have ever come up with. And we're, even if we, and we can all acknowledge that on this show, but we're still downstream from it. And from personal experience, it takes, it's the work of a lifetime to not fall back into that default mode where, when operating, right? So when I come back to this idea of what they're doing here and what they get from us, where the imaginal isn't in us, we're in it, which means that a capacity to change how we think and feel, more importantly, in an embodied sense, and to operate at that imaginal dream level is really powerful. And it's real. It's some kind of real, right? It's not, it's a different category of real to this microphone, but it's some kind of real. And in that area, they get stuff from us. And this comes back to things like hag attacks and whatever that is there, but that's not all of them. Like the good thing about an animist frame is that you say the cosmos is a community of beings, and we can resist individual or totalizing frameworks for what these things are doing here. Because I think he's right about that.
In the same way that we would resist totalizing our view of like the biological world or something. I mean, the spiritual world certainly would be as diverse as the biological, if there were such a world populated by beings. You know, there's jellyfish, and then there's humans and all sorts of things in between. I like this. And this is not just like speculative work for people who are listening and aren't familiar with these lines of thought. I mean, there's real academic work being done. Thomas Nagel at Oxford, his most recent book, Mind and Cosmos, I think, argues for very much this sort of view of reality, this what we call panpsychism in the philosophy world, or Jeffrey Kripal's work in comparative religion takes the same sort of view of sort of transnormal experience or something. So it's not as taboo as it used to be.
Yeah, it's not. Well, it's what all of anthropology runs on now, right? Because I went looking. Anthropology is the perfect academic discipline to understand what's powerfully wrong about academia and the promise that it can hold, because anthropology is literally the 19th century science of deciding why white people are better than non-white people. And, and you have universities around the world filled with like brown people's bones that are in the process of being handed back, like, whoops, sorry. Like it started, we're talking a low base here. We're talking anthropological work was boiling the flesh off African skulls and filling them with rice, and then filling white skulls with rice, and then pouring the rice out and saying, oh, there's rice in that pile.
Yeah,
it's like orc medicine times 100. It's so stupid, right? And it does, to its credit, it then spent basically doing its best in the 20th century to go, might have got this wrong, and wrangled with that, because what is the study of the human? Anthropology, like, what is the study of the human? It's like, well, what is a human, and what kinds there are? And one of the things it got to towards the end of the last century, beginning of this one, is the famous and overused anthropological term. But in short, anthropology was the first discipline, I think, to satisfactorily find a way to build a method of academic inquiry on non-European minds, on like non-European epistemologies. And the main one comes through Brazil, through Eduardo Viveiros de Castro and his decades of research in Amazonia. And that was the kind of the turn that allowed anthropology to have new ways of attending upon and generating truths, generating ontologies that don't come out of the the European mindset. And so in that you have this the premise that the cosmos is built of persons, like the underlying stuff of the cosmos is personhood that is shaped by bodies. So the underlying stuff is, and that's quite important, right? So you can build any, literally any kind of academic inquiry upon that. And people have and do, and it's yielding powerful results. It's a way of highlighting the foundational premises that can head, I don't want to say head it, take us off in the wrong direction, because it's not like there isn't utility in historic modes of academic thought, mm-hmm. but the catch is to not mistake doing that for reality. And anthropology sure. got there first and best, I think. It actually allows us to borrow other people's minds and bodies for an attempt to experience, like other humans, like to for an attempt to frame and encounter the cosmos in a way that provides co-learning. And that's the stuff of my second book, or the second book in this series, Animistic, is that. It's like, what happens when we situate ourselves in a theory of mind that comes from, ultimately, a academic lineage, because it's generated in that way, but it's generated in a successful encounter with a collection of cosmovisions that operate in a very different context, which is the Amazon, right? And the Amazon's a really powerful one, because it's not just the psychedelics and so on. But my first Amazonian dieta, we have this idea that like we're going away, like we're going to get away from all the noise and the craziness into the Amazon and do this work, which you do. But it's not, once you get there, you realize like this is like trying to find, like being on the New York subway is getting away from things. Like it is so crowded and it is so loud at night. You are just surrounded.
The jungle is not a quiet.
Yeah. You don't like mountaintops, I think. And even then you just have big beings near you. But Amazonian cosmovisions have had to get very, very, very good at relationality and understanding the agency of beings outside of the human, because they're in the most crowded place on Earth. Right. That's what they're for. And so they have something to say about a crowded cosmos. And I think that's why it's very useful to learn what we can about that cosmovision, because they're literally better at crowded cosmoses. And that's basically what we're talking about here.
Yeah. That's the underlying thesis, is that the cosmos is more crowded than with just particles or just minds that we recognize as arising from brains or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Which sort of begs the question. If consciousness happened before the Big Bang, like, is the Big Bang a result of consciousness, or is consciousness
correct? So
right, but or is consciousness a byproduct of the universe? Right. So it's fun. That's a fun question to ask, because I mean, either or has huge implications. But if consciousness first, that'd be amazing.
So consciousness is one of those terms that I leave in the 20th century. It hit this kind of study in the 60s and 70s when the Orientalist arrival of transcendental meditation, all this kind of stuff hit, right? Like real hippie stuff. It's all consciousness. It's all one mind, man. The trouble with that is we're still not good at theory of mind and consciousness. So what is it? Like, what is consciousness then, right? And when we, unfortunately, when it comes out of our mouths, we basically mean human thinking patterns that, but more specifically, human thinking patterns that emerge in our cultural context. And that's not right. And you can find, obviously it's not right, but like, it was too complex for me to try and transmute that into something useful. And so this way I use words like attending. So attention is the underlying stuff, and personhood. Because I don't know what consciousness is. I don't think it's a category that I haven't been able to tell you what it is good for. And I use this all the time. Like, you go from materialism to something that breaks materialism, which is some kind of panpsychism, it's all mind situation. And that's literally 90% of the way there, right? I'm actually quibbling about the last 10%, because the thing I mostly want people to do is get out of the falsified premise of materialism and move into something else. But once you've made that 90% jump into something else, then it's like I start to find that I start to find the shortcomings in a It's All Consciousness Man frame. And that's not how it operates somewhere like Amazonia, right? It's not like the attending and attention and relating and personhood. These are the personness is the stuff of the universe, not consciousness, because that then expresses itself in bodies. And so you think differently based on a body, because a tree doesn't have a brain like a peccary does. But it's made of the same personness. And it's really, it interfaces more with an understanding of the spirit world. But like, these are all questions that people should go through and find plainly their own answers to. And I think the great invitation of doing UAP stuff right, yeah. is to quickly get past the materialism thing. And you spend enough time in like the It's All Consciousness and go, this, well, at least I do. And then you start picking holes in that as well. And you have to move to the next one. And you've got to like Goldilocks your way to the epistemology that gives you the most satisfying cosmovision, I think.
I think my dissertation director in university used to love to say that, you know, whenever anybody would say, well, like, it all boils down to blank. And she would just interrupt me like, it doesn't all boil down. There's no thing that you can arrive at and say, oh, it's all just really this, right? The fundamental premise is that reality is multiple and explosive and diverse and irreducible. And that's so even the It's All Consciousness Man view, people who adopt that view and think that they're breaking out of a framework, breaking out of materialism, but they're not breaking out of the way of thinking.
Exactly. That says, wonderful.
Oh, it's all just one thing really at the end.
So Yamanahua shamanism, Graham Harvey is an academic, describes it. It's not a collection of things known. It's an assembly of techniques for knowing, right? And what I like about animism in general is basically what you just said, but with a bone through the nose. Like what I like about animism in general is, and particularly like an Amazonian shamanic version of it, is it has the humility of like, you aren't going to know, right? And it's you don't, the totalizing worldview is itself one of those Greek things that we've inherited. This idea that we need it in some kind of like Dionysius, the Areopagite, great chain of being. We need a totalizing explanation of the cosmos, right? Like it emanates from here, it comes down through these, and that's how it works. And the role of philosophy or science is to fit the new bits into it, right? Sure. That's gone. Goodbye, right? That's a beautiful song. Like I like it. But I put it in the context of a Yamanahua shamanism, which is like, that's one technique for knowing things. And they don't, a cosmos that is a community of beings, you isn't one that submits to explanation. You just have assemblies of techniques for knowing. And knowing for like practical reasons, which isn't to diminish it to utilitarianism, because a practical reason includes the philosophical satisfaction of feeling at home in a magical cosmos. So it's not like, oh, it's not, well, they were just focused on how effectively to hunt. They were definitely very focused on that, because otherwise you die, but that's not it. Like an assembly of techniques for knowing things like you are at home in this living cosmos is one of them, but that's crucial, I think. And I agree. Like you move through that process, and particularly if you, And UAP research can move you through that process, right? You go from materialism to a bigger totalizing framework that incorporates what you currently know about the phenomena, and you can stay there until you find phenomena that's like, okay, it's doing it again and pulling me out to another one. And where I've got at the moment is assembly of techniques for knowing.
I think that a lot of people who listen to this podcast because they're so interested in UAP are going to be frustrated by this conversation, but it's okay because it tracks exactly the sort of trajectory of exploration that at least I've been through with UAP, thinking that by the beginning, it's all just fancy cars, right? Somebody else has got a better car than we have, and they're flying around here and doing something. And then the evidence just doesn't, that explanation does not encompass or have anything to do with the vast array of experiences that people who encounter these phenomena have. And so you have to step out a little bit, and you keep doing that. And once you step out one time, you realize that doesn't encompass it either. And that doesn't either. And then you get to all this Fortean shit where it's like people having, you know, a being comes down out of a ship to argue with you about what time it is, or to just speak some sort of philosophical nonsense to you or something. And then you have to arrive at a place where you say, well, whatever explains this has to be something bigger than physics. We're not just explaining how a ship moves the way it does, which is an interesting question, but it's inextricable now from questions about why people's encounters have this sort of like transcendental element to it, where they feel that they're being given some sort of almost incomprehensible message about the nature of reality and the self and death and all those things.
Like, or abilities. They got abilities as well. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like Gary Nolan's exploring this sort of shit right now. Yeah.
And they're not supposed to be comprehensible, right? Like you don't comprehend an ayahuasca journey. You encounter it and you experience it. Like that's the... where one of those similarities is with the UAP phenomena is that, like, and that's a good example of like, what's the time? It's like, you just showed up in this airship to us.
Maybe you don't know what time it is. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you operate at that level so that we don't get stuck in the thinking trap. Like that's actually the whole point. Like you're supposed to experience and attend upon. Right. And it's funny. It doesn't invalidate, like I said, it doesn't invalidate the ones that come here in buses and so on, because even what's so cool about, let's just say, the era of materialism in the early version of UAP is we see a flying saucer and like, well, how does that work? And actually, if you follow them along that thread, you break materialist physics anyway, because you're going to have to start thinking about electrogravitics and so on. So even staying at like an ETH level, it's still going to pull you into, well, how does that work, and make it bigger. And so like examples of this for me, if people want to, there was an artist, a Peruvian artist called Pablo Amaringo, who died about 20 years ago. I met his son last year in Pucallpa in the Amazon when I was back there. And he, if you in your head right now are thinking of like ayahuasca or psychedelic art, you are thinking of probably a Pablo Amaringo print.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He pioneered this art form. And I went to the school that he founded that his son still runs when he was there. And if you get a look at his artwork and actually examine it, it's got all the plant spirits and the water spirits and all the rest of it that you'd expect in the Amazon. And there are flying saucers and there are cities that live in the river that look like underwater phenomena, that all this kind of stuff. And you ask him about it, you ask any of these Peruvian curanderos, and you get the same idea. It's like, yeah, there are some of these beings from the stars that help us with healing. For me, coming back to how I want to frame, there is a reality to this that invites us to look at our frame rather than what it is. Look at Pablo Amaringo's art, because the cunning traditions or curanderismo in places like Peru has Indian chakras. They use Buddhist healers. There are spirit teachers that come in. There's the plant spirits. There's Otorongo, jaguar. But there's all these underwater cities and flying saucers and all this other stuff that happens. And you realize that this is a catalog of encounters that we can put beside some of the more famous ones that we get in a Western context, because it's literally flying saucers, but it's flying saucers landing and speaking to a ayahuascaero who is so good at this. Like, he served medicine for the president of Peru and what have you. And that's for me where, like, if people want to go, okay, hang on, how am I going to put this together in my head? Google image search some Pablo Amaringo art and look at what he's seeing there, and look at how he saw these kind of craft-based encounters in the context of a spirit cosmos, right? Because that, I think that can help people go, all right, it's a way of like loosening up the body armor of sitting with like, okay, but I just did all this work and I'm very satisfied with my understanding of what these things are. And that doesn't, the thing is like, you get to keep that. You get to keep all your memorized knowledge of what the triangle over Brazil or you know, Belgium looked like. You get to memorize and keep all of that, but you can situate it in a context to say, well, Pablo Amaringo saw it like this. And that, I think, for me, that really helps. It really helps people to situate a bit more of the nuts and boltsness in what it might look like in a Cosmovision that's very different to ours.
Right, because the nuts and bolts questions are still there. Like, we still totally. Are interested in knowing how a craft can do the things that it does. I mean, those questions aren't invalid, but this phenomenon, I think I've become pretty wholly convinced, is not reducible to a set of nuts and bolts questions. It's probably not reducible, but the best framework for it is going to be all sorts of knowledge that I currently don't even recognize as valid or don't have any conceptual framework. So I'm trying to explode that sort of framework of understanding and investigation for myself right now. And we'll have links to Pablo Amoringo's art in the descriptions of the video for people who are interested. I'm not sure I've ever seen this stuff, but I'm really, sounds like Hieronymus Bosch mixed with, like, I don't know, Alex Gray or something. I don't know. It's probably okay. Like Tutu.
Yeah, that's actually not bad.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Or no, I haven't seen it. That's pretty impressive. Yeah, I hadn't seen it, but that's a good description. Yeah, there's something about, to be said to somebody even like yourself, Gordon, that you're an intellectual, you're spiritual, and it seems that the UAP phenomenon is very much attracted to people like yourselves. I've never heard of a psychopath having an abduction, right? I've never heard of somebody who is purely evil ever talk about having a sighting. It's only people who seem to be very kind of heart, open spiritually, and there's some about them that they're privy to this. There's certain people that'll just never be privy to this because their mindset or who they are will never allow them to see it, unfortunately. So, you know, when we say we're all created equal, not in the UAP phenomenon, unfortunately. Again, I've never heard of a psychopath being taken aboard a craft and having experiments done on them or having some sort of hybrid made from them. That just does not exist. It's not existent in the UAP world.
That's very interesting. Yeah. That's very interesting, right? Because if we go back to the, you know, it's like a magic eye puzzle, like unfocus your eyes and we look at the overlap between spirits and UFOs and demons and UFOs consequently. Occultism is certainly suffers from an abundance of psychopaths who will dick about with demons and, you know, and really antisocial behavior and all that kind of stuff. And so they're definitely, because a big part of shamanic healing is like, let's say removing cords and connections to entities and people that are now toxic or unhelpful. And if you fuck around with demons, you will find out and you will get like, you will feel the results like on an energetic and toxic level and so on. So that's interesting, right? Because there is a category or class of beings that are drawn to them, but you're right. Like I can't think of anyone who makes it into these highly produced Netflix documentaries who appears to be a
no. And they're all creative.
I haven't thought of that.
Yeah. There you go. I gave you something to think on.
Yeah.
Gordon, where can people find you? Obviously, Rune Soup is very popular, but where can people find you across the board? Where are you online?
RuneSoup.com is the best place for like the blog and the podcast and the membership. You can find the books there. I am back on X. I'm going to start calling it X. Gordon_White, GORDON_White. So you can find all that kind of contact stuff. RuneSoup.com, easy enough to remember.
Beautiful. And the final question is for people who want to understand more about magic or the sort of view of the world that you are exploring here with us. What are your book recommendations?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because I had time to think about, this is a different question to like, what are the best books on doing magic, right? Because what you're actually asking is there are people listening to or watching this who are like, huh, that's activating something in me that I wish to investigate further. Like it's
a tingle. Maybe there's something there.
Yeah. So consequently, the best place to start is, so this is a list of books that I would say are overlaps, right? So Real Magic by Dr. Dean Radin is a overview of how parapsychology, which low-key he got from me as an idea, but like that parapsychology is a examination of the realities of things that we used to call magic. And so that's a really good frame for people who have maybe in this world and are familiar with things like remote viewing to begin that process, is to go and look at that. Then what I would say with that in mind, and if you've already read your Jacques, You should read Owen Davies' book, Grimoires. So he's a British historian who's, that's the history of grimoires, of magical books, right? So if you, and he, it's a straight down the line materialist history. So it's not like telling you stories of what happens when certain people summon these beings and whatever. But if you come at it post Dean Radin, you're going to start to understand, oh, so this is the thread of history that I maybe haven't looked at, that contains a whole bunch of not just encounters, but almost like rules for contact that I hadn't considered before. So I would do that. I would go real magic, grimoires, and then I would suggest animistic. Funnily enough, if you're going in that direction, Starships is a bit more UFO-y and a bit more ancient Egypt-y and whatever. But animistic, because if you've got there, what animistic is my exploration of what I've been talking about, which is, well, what does reality look like if we situate ourselves in, let's say, an Amazonian shamanic cosmovision? Because you've just imported the overlap between like magic and parapsychology. You've overlapped that with a history of magic that you maybe haven't seen before. And that's a popular book. These, none of these are academic books. You can, these are beach reads if you want, right? And then, so that would be it. That's a specific sequence, I would say, to get people to invite them, if they are so called to it, to have a frame or cosmovision that in, that incorporates like living spirits and also UFO. And that would be the journey. And I think if you get to the end of that, you won't be doing magic, but you'll be like, okay, I think I broadly got a perspective on how this might all hang together, or what, more specifically, what magic might have to say about this, and then I can go further into it if I wish.
Perfect. Fantastic conversation. Yeah, this was awesome. Yeah.
We appreciate you, man. This was a great episode. We'll have a little bit that we record for the Patreon viewers after this. But thank you, Gordon, for being here, and we hope to talk to you again soon.